So I just sent you all an email about 15 minutes ago saying that the new homework is assigned. The old homework is not yet graded. I hope to have it back by today, but I lied. Monday's a holiday, so I hope I'll be able to return it by Wednesday. The new homework is doing things with likelihood, doing things with coefficient of, well, the shape parameter or coefficient of variation, whatever parameterization you want to use, of the variation of rates among sites for either protein or DNA data, and then doing some bootstrapping as well. It's a fair amount of work. I don't know that it's more work than the current one. But an early start on it won't be a bad idea. We're going to cover some of the rate variation stuff today. Let's see. Before I start, any other questions or, yeah.
Is there any program to optimize the gamma parameter?
Some of the ones will do it. PalpStar will do it. I think RaxML will do it. RaxML is free. Mega may do it. If you're on a Windows machine, you can run Mega on a Mac, but it's. You have to run a Windows emulator on the Mac, which is more trouble than most people are willing to go to. But RaxML is a good possibility. I'm not sure about FiML. FiML is another fast likelihood program, but I don't know whether or not it has that feature, but it may well. So that's one of the things I ask you to do, although I give you an idea how to do it with less work. Ideally, when you evaluate the likelihood on each tree, it also optimizes these other parameters. My programs, Phylip tends not to do that, and so it's harder to get those out of Phylip. And I suggest on the homework that if you have been using Phylip, why not try something else? I'm not trying to force you to use Phylip. It's about the fifth or sixth most used package, but there's a bunch more that are more widely used these days. Okay, so let's see. Where we are at on the likelihood stuff, I'm still talking about computational considerations. What I'm going to quickly show you is that the tree, if you're doing this algorithm in which you update little likelihood vectors down the tree for each site, and you have a tree which has, let's say that the root of the tree is here, and there's a branch of length T6 and a branch of length T8, and connected to this is a subtree, some stuff, more branches, and here's another subtree, and I just have them shaded differently. The question will be, is it true that if I reroute the tree, say, to the base of 6, to node 6, so that now the unrooted tree is the same if we keep this branch equal to T6 plus T8, its branch lengths. So that if the likelihood's depended only on the unrooted tree, these two have the same unrooted tree, so they should be the same. Well, are they? And what I have is, it's given in the book. You can show that if you have a reversible Markov process, so it has this property that, given basically two sequences, you can't tell which came first because they with the same branch length in between them, you can't tell which came first, and that's this condition here of probability of starting with X and then going to Y is the same as the probability of starting with Y and going to X. Well, if you put, this should be a Z. If you take the expression for the tree that I showed you, after you've peeled the likelihoods, you've pruned the likelihoods down so that you started with ones at the tips and you worked your way down within each of these subtrees, both of which these two have not changed. The overall likelihood at this site in this case will be peeling this down, the thing at this tip, the thing at that tip, and then Let's see if I can show you. This is the conditional likelihood at T6. This is the conditional likelihood at T7. These are the likelihoods given that you have X at the root, and up one branch you have Y, and up the other branch you have Z. And you can use this to show that that expression is equal to it, and that becomes a likelihood expression for starting out at X. Let's see if I get this right. Do I have this right? No. I believe I had to do this. This is the probability of starting at Y. Yeah, starting at the bottom is Y. So Z is above X, and X is above Y. That's it. And then there's Y down at the base. Anyway, if you work it out, you'll see that that's the expression. And you use this to show that the two are the same. Which shows you that within any branch, I can take that branch to be the root. Within that branch, I can move the root around to either end of the branch. And at one point in the original paper on this, I called it the pulley principle, because it's just a statement about reversibility. And it says that there's these two subtrees, and there's a branch between them, and it's as if there's a pulley here that you can pull, you can pull the branch up over here and down over there by the same amount. That amounts to just moving the root to one end or the other end of the branch. Well, what you can then show is, having reached the end of the branch, it's in contact with a couple more branches, with two or more branches. And you can then roll it out into any one of those branches. So you can actually move the root anywhere in the tree. And the likelihood expression is not different, it's the same. And that leads to some computational conveniences, one of which is, if you want to estimate these branch lengths, we use this pruning algorithm that updates likelihood down these subtrees. When we get down here, we basically now have a problem that just has two, it's as if it had only two species. And when we go to try out different branch lengths here, we only have to do it with this computation here, because the rest of it doesn't change. So basically, we can try different lengths for T6 and T8, if that's what they were. But actually, since it's unrooted, it's just the total length that matters. And we can try different total lengths. And we will get different likelihoods for those, but we can easily find what the optimum likelihood is. So you can go to any branch in the tree, declare the root to be on it, make sure that reusing previously pruned stuff, we can update the pruned sets. Usually you don't have to update too much. And then take that branch and try different lengths for it very quickly without having to go back and redo all the machinery for the rest of the tree. So it makes for some very quick updating. You can maximize the likelihood with respect to one branch. Now, once you do that, that changes the pruned likelihoods in other parts of the tree. So you then have to go back out to other branches and update them and make sure their lengths get adjusted properly. That may seem like an endless process, but it's not, because each stage of this raises the total likelihood. It's maximizing it. And it's well known that I have bounded a monotonic sequence bounded above converges. So this thing, it's bounded above by the highest possible likelihood of any tree. And you could basically show that it's not going to fall into a loop, because if it fell into a loop, it would at some point have to go down in its likelihood. The only possible loops would be if you got to a perfectly flat plateau of likelihood and then you wandered on it. if you go back and forth in the tree of a given topology, considering it as an unrooted tree, taking different branches and maximizing the likelihood with respect to their legs, that process will converge, and it does pretty well. I mean, the first pass through gets everything pretty close, and as you go back, they get even closer very quickly, and they generally converge pretty fast. But you still have to search over tree topologies, just as you do with distance methods, just as you do with parsimony methods. Okay. Yeah, this is just showing that you do the pruning, and then you prune to the bottom, and when you do prune to the bottom, that's when you use the branch lengths here, so you can try different values of those very quickly. Okay, so that's that. And if you have a different branch length, then you just do the last little bit again. Here's a numerical example. It's using the 7 species primate data that we have, which is available on the website, on the course website. These are either their sites in mitochondrial DNA of these primates and 2 other mammals. They were selected, they're either from the D-loop control region of the mitochondrial DNA, or what happened is Masami Hasegawa, a leading molecular evolutionist in Japan in the mid-1980s, collected this set of data. He didn't want to have any variation in evolutionary rate, because at that point the likelihood models didn't allow for that. Now they do. And so what he did is he said, well, let's take the D-loop region and go off into the nearby coding sequence, but only take synonymous sites. So it's D-loop sequence plus at the end some synonymous sites nearby. And they seem to be about similar in the rate of evolution. When you use, this is for the F84 model, using DNAML and Phylum, and what you get out is a tree that looks reasonable. These are branch lengths. What you find is the nearest relative of humans is chimp. Now, as far as rooting this, if you assume that all the apes are a monophyletic group, which is not a very controversial matter, then it suggests that the root is down in here somewhere. Let us see how, if you were to just use considerations of a molecular clock and say, is there a point that's approximately equidistant from the tips? Well, it won't be exact, because this is not fit. We have not fitted a clock-like tree here. This is 17, let's go from chip, 17% plus 4%, well, plus 7%, that'd be about 25%, 29, 30%, 42%. So it's 0.42 of total branch length to here. It's 0.48 to there. The root would actually come around somewhere around here, possibly up in this branch, if you wanted to, if you said, well, let's try to find a place that makes things as clock-like as possible. From other considerations on other sequences, it looks like the root is actually about there. So we're a little off. But this is only 232 nucleotides. It's not a lot of sequence. Makes a good example. The log likelihood is minus 1,406, basically, 1,405. Some people looked at these and they said, why is it negative? Oh my God, the log likelihood is negative. Something's wrong. And the answer is, think about it. The likelihood is a probability of getting all the data. A probability is less than one, except in the trivial case where there's only one possible kind of data, which is we're not obviously there. The log of anything that's less than one is negative, so everything's okay. The log is supposed to, when you see a positive like log, then you should, with molecular sequence data, then really worry. I mean, something is really wrong. And sometimes people will say, well, look, log likelihood is minus 1,400. That means that the probability for this tree is e to the minus 1,400, which is an incredibly tiny probability. doesn't that mean something is wrong? And my response is, no, it doesn't mean anything is wrong. If you're tossing coins, the outcome you get will be a half to the number of tosses, say for a heads probability of a half. The more tossing you do, the tinier that number will be. But that's okay, more tossing is better. It just means there were many, many other possible ways that these data could have come out. And generally, that's true. The more that gets to be a smaller number, the more data you have. So really, there's no indication that anything is seriously wrong from that. The topology, if the root is out here, has human and chimp closest, gorilla next, orang next, and gibbon, and that's believed. That's the sort of consensus topology that molecular sequences show. Okay. So it's just a numerical example. Here I give it a this is not in the book, because it was done more recently. Here I simulated data on a true four-species tree. I simulated these were DNA sequences that I simulated under the, I think it's Jukes-Cantor, might have been Komuratu parameter. Here's the true tree. If you fit trees to those, if you take the data set and you take the first 100 or the first 200 or the first 500, so it's just like that parsimony example that I showed you, there are fewer points, but, and you maximize the likelihood under this tree topology, optimizing the, fitting the branch lengths as well, and you do it under this tree topology, so those would be, that would be the one where the long branches have attracted each other. The truth is up here. What I got in this particular case was the wrong tree was preferentially selected until you got to 500 sites. After that, the true tree was preferred. And as time went on, this is a log likelihood per site, so I divided by the number of sites. And it's basically converging to having this amount of difference between it. I think if we went out further, this would flatten out, but the two would remain the same. So it's consistent. It's going to the true tree in a case where parsimony is not consistent. So that's just another numerical example. Okay. So where I want to go from that and talk for most of the rest of the lecture is about a machinery for what happens, how do you deal with rate variation among sites? Because we know that little of the DNA sequence that we look at has exactly the same rate of change at different sites. There are regions that are conserved because they have some functional significance. There are regions that are coding for, they're coding for loci, for proteins or RNAs or whatever. And those are going to have different rates of evolution, so you want to accommodate that. Now, if you knew the rate at each site, if somebody magically told you, okay, site 1 has rate 1, site 2 has rate 2.6, site 3 has rate 0.9, and you had that set of numbers, could you evaluate the likelihood? And the answer is actually very easily. You would just do what we do in the likelihood models. The overall likelihood, which is this, it's the probability of the data given the tree with branch lengths and these rates. And it's going to be a product of probabilities at the different sites. And at the ith site, the data is D super brackets I, so it's just a column of data from the data matrix at that site. Its probability of occurrence depends on the ith rate, it doesn't depend on the others. But how do we get it? How do we get this number? Up till now, I've been telling you how to get that, where you have the topology of the tree and branch lengths. So can anybody tell me for just this term, what would be a straightforward way of getting a computer program to compute it for now with a rate of 2 instead of a rate of 1? So I have one site, it's going twice as fast as the average. I know how to compute the probability on the tree using all this machinery for the tree and branch lengths when the site rate is 1, but somebody comes along and tells me, now get it for 2. Okay, well, I'm going to have to give you the... okay.
Can you shorten the branch length? Sorry, that's not... No.
If you're going from a rate of 1 to a rate of 2, which should you do?
Lengthen.
Yeah, you should lengthen the branch. Because remember, the branch is equal to its rate, its length in time. The branch length is the length in time times the rate. So if you double the rate, it's as if you doubled the time.
Okay.
So twice as fast evolution in all of these models is exactly the same as evolution for twice as long a time. So all you have to do is go into the tree, double all the branch lengths, and just do the computation. So it's the same computation. It's just you double all the branch lengths. So if you knew all the rates, it's very easy to go along and just, with each site, use the appropriate multiplier with the rate that somebody magically gave you. But alas, they don't magically give you that. If you have some uncertainty about rates, there's an even a little trickier issue. You could say, well, suppose that there was a gamma distribution of rates. So we don't know which of those rates is the rate. We know that for this site, this is the product over sites, what the likelihood would be, I've called this L super I of R, I should have said of D. It should really have been the data. It should be L super I of the data given the tree and R. That's really the ith column of the data. Okay, that's what I should have put in there. And what you would have to do is say the overall probability is equal to the average, averaging over these rates. And the average is simply the integral of the density function of the gamma distribution times the rates. In principle, you could, first of all, you could look and say, can I compute it analytically? There actually are, in principle, ways of doing it, but they're not computationally practical. There are ways of writing down the expression for this. It can be solved in that sense. But unfortunately, in a tree, these expressions get bigger and bigger and uglier the more tips there are on the tree. And it turns out, so far, no one has tried to use that. Instead, what you could say is, well, let's take a numerical integral. Let's divide the rate axis up into little slices and compute this thing for each slice and then average them numerically against what the height of the density function is at that point. It turns out to be computationally very hard to do that with a lot of slices, so what people do, have been doing since Zihang Yang's papers in the mid-90s, is to say, well, maybe we can numerically approximate this by a function that's not the gamma, but is a histogram that approximates the gamma, and it's got a modest number of classes. So it might have 10 different classes. And then what you have to figure out are what the probabilities in those histograms will be. And then this thing becomes, because it has a limited number of classes, just becomes a sum of the likelihood or the kth value of the rate multiplied by the appropriate weight, which is the area in that slice of the histogram. So you can do it. I have some detailed suggestions to improve that basically nobody uses. Everybody's using the original suggestion of Zihang. Anyway, okay. So in principle, if I give you a amount of rate variation, a rate variation parameter, say this alpha, you could have a machinery work out what those classes ought to be and get a histogram of, say, 10 classes that it comes as close as we can to approximating that gamma. And then we just do, basically, we then do the likelihood computation 10 times, once for each value of R, and a weighted average of those. So it's the same computation. It's multiplied. The difficulty of the computation is simply multiplied by the number of classes in the histogram. So that is so it's doable. Maybe it takes 10 times as much work instead of the original amount of work. Okay. Now that's with a model where the rates are assumed. It's very important to realize what we're assuming here is we have variation in rates at each site separately, and we're just taking products of the resulting integrals, which means we're assuming the rates are varying independently from site to site. They could be high, they could be low at one site. When you go to the next site, you're assumed to have no information as to whether it's going to be high or low there. The two are not correlated. The two are supposed to be independent. That is widely used. That assumption is widely used. Most of the programs you see that are out there are doing this. And they're doing this independent product. I have very mixed feelings about it. Part of it is that both Ziheng Yang and separately a paper by me and Gary Churchill in the mid-90s, Ziheng was published first, came up with a machinery for dealing with cases where they're not independent. So, of course, I'd like people to use that machinery. And, of course, I built it into my own programs, and Ziheng has it in his programs. But everybody else's programs don't use it. And every year I give, every time I talk about this, I urge people to think that way. And it's over 20 years, you know, it's been 20 years now. And basically, I have not succeeded. Nor has Ziheng Yang succeeded in persuading anybody to think about this. All the programs out there just say gamma distribution independent rates at each site. But I don't think reality is like that. Let's see, we're coming to hidden Markov models, but let me just mention why. And it's simply that when you get into a region of DNA where the rates are higher, generally that holds for more than one nucleotide. There might be a transcription factor there, so there might be conservation there, so you get to the first site of the transcription factor, binding site, and rates are low. Well, you know, they're likely to be low at the next site also. So there is a non-random association. Similarly, within a coding sequence, of course, they oscillate on a period 3. And in addition, within a coding sequence, it depends upon is that whole amino acids in the act? If it's an enzyme, is it in the active site? Or is it in some alpha helix? Or is it in a beta sheet or miscellaneous? Is it on the interior of the three-dimensional structure or on the exterior? And those are all places that once you get to them, that predisposes you to lower or higher rates and does so for more than one nucleotide. So the whole thing is, I think, a fairly serious question that is mostly being dealt with by people pretending it's not an issue. Yeah.
Could you do some kind of analysis, try to figure out which sites are dependent and purposely make a new set of independent sites?
Well, certainly if you were to go along the genome and sample sites, one every 100, you're probably going to be much more independent than if you took adjacent sites. I don't know very many people who want to do that, though. You know, want to throw away 99% of the data. So,
I guess.
In you get it to be closer to the statistical model, but at the cost of discarding much of the data, I think.
I see.
That's the problem there. Who had their hand up first? You did, yeah.
If you had a protein and you did like a DNDS analysis and
yep.
you found that there were some parts of the protein which were conserved and other parts, you know, which were maybe under adaptive evolution, so
yeah.
it was higher, could you break
I haven't heard of people trying to do that. I think what you, if you somehow knew how to break it up, which is a big question, okay. First, I should say to people, DNDS is just the synonymous, non-synonymous machinery that I talked to you about in talking about the codon model. It's estimating this parameter omega. If you took a bunch of sites that all had about the same rate, then you could say, well, let's just treat them as not varying in rate. Or let's just estimate an overall rate for them, but not worry about, and then within that chunk, they'll be relatively more independent. So yes, in principle, you could do that. I am unaware of anyone doing it that way. The machinery I'm going to tell you about does, in some senses, is sort of like that, but it doesn't really explicitly break things. It uses this hidden Markov model machinery. I'll show you in a second. You had a question?
I was just a surrogate hand picture, sorry.
Oh, you were trying to call attention.
Yes.
No, actually, it's quite visible. Okay, so there's a hidden Markov model machinery. It was first introduced in 1996, I think, or 95, by Zihen Yang, and the next year by Gary Churchill and I in a paper, and these were independent discoveries, although ours came out after theirs. And basically what it says is, okay, we have a finite number of rates. Let's imagine that that the histogram is really true. So instead of a gamma distribution, we have these 10 different rates that could be, any of which could be the proper rates. Let's see. Yeah, I'm going to gesture at this picture and then go back and show you the text. Here I'm showing three different rates, but imagine it could be an array of 10. Now, in the machinery that assumes independence, you're simply going to compute the probability of the data on the given tree. Whenever you're evaluating a tree, you compute the probability of that column on that tree with rate 10, with everybody having with this site having rate 10, with this site having rate 2, and with this site having rate 0.3. And then you do a weighted average of those, okay, for your given amount of rate variation. And you would do that at every site. But the hidden Markov model machinery makes an additional assumption. It says, no, the sites are not, the true rates are not independent. Let us assume that out there in nature is a magical process that acts, but we don't know exactly what it does. And it goes along here and picks a rate at each site. And furthermore, we're going to make life easy for ourselves by saying the magical process of picking a rate, this is before you look at the data. This is done when the universe is set up or something. Anyway, it's done magically. It picks a particular combination of rates, and let's assume that the way it works is that having picked the rate here, there's a Markov process of change among rates. And this process can wander up or wander down, but where it goes next depends only on where it is, depends on the rate at this site. So if you're at this site here, where you go next doesn't depend on how you got there, it's a Markov process. We will be assuming some things about what it looks like, but it picks a combination of rates. Okay. Now, if you do that, there turns out to be an acute computational way of doing all of the calculations without some of the difficulties you might think. Let's go back to this statement here. I'm just saying there's a finite number of rates, there are probabilities at each site, the events are correlated. The hidden process that's not visible to us does this Markov process going along the sequence. And the probability, here's the key, the probability of our seeing some data particular set of sequences. The ideal way we would compute it is to consider all possible combinations of rates. That's all paths through that array. And for each one, then it's just like being given those rates, and we do the computation, the given rates computation. Now that sounds, if you start thinking about that, sounds horrific, because the number of paths through the array is huge. For example, even if there are only two rates, there'd be two choices at each site. Two to the, you know, if you go 100 bases down, two to the hundred, so there are 2 to the 100 possible paths. And you might look at it and say, that's going to be computationally unbelievably bad. Let's see. Yeah, here's this stuff. It's just telling you what we talked about earlier, which is the probability for a given site and a given rate is just the thing you get by multiplying the branch lengths all by that rate. And you need to sum over all paths. So basically what we're going to do is we're going to say, for a given tree to evaluate it, here's the data, consider all paths, work out the likelihood of the data on each of the paths, and weight them, put them together weighted appropriately. Computationally a non-starter. I'm going to, probably the best thing for me to do is not to try to go through all the algebra here. It's in the book if you want to know it. But there is a way, here it is written out, probability of data given tree, the sum of, these are the categories. In the previous one, there would be three values of I, 1, 2, and 3. There'd be, for P sites, there'd be three at each. So the multiple summation is 3 to the number of sites here. And then the probability under the Markov process of going to those rates, of the magical hidden process coming up with those rates, times the probability of the data if you're given those rates. Okay. And that's the one. It looks fine, but you begin to realize it has a vast number of possible paths. And remember that once you know the rates, in this term, the likelihood is then independent, the process of evolution is then independent, except that it has the particular rate at each site, but what it then does with that rate is independent of what happens at any other site. Please.
Is that why we can do the polling thing on the
branches? No, I don't think. I'm trying to see. It's a as I'll show you in a moment, it is a relative of why we can move the likelihood vectors down at any one site down the tree. It will gain us something like that. Okay. And let's see. This is just the same expression, and now I just have the fact that the probability of the data is just given a particular set of rates, is just a product of terms, one for each site. Here's a thing showing the 3 to the 100 is a very big number. It's like 5 times 10 to the 47. But I wouldn't be telling you this if there wasn't a way of economizing. And what it turns out is, here's the same expression. All I've done is move the stuff at site 1 together, the stuff at site 2 together. We took those products and we just moved terms around. And you know what's going to happen. I'm going to be moving summation signs in. It's really another dynamic programming algorithm. And when you finish doing that, it's the sum of overall I of this stuff times the sum overall I2 of that stuff times the sum overall I3 and so on, so on, so on. If you put parentheses around them, I don't know if I have you can go from the inside outwards in a way that is very, very similar to what you do when you move stuff down a tree. And I'm not going to go over the algebra. Bum, 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 bum. You basically will start with the last site, and you have your rates, and then you can just compute the likelihood given each rate, and then you come back one site and compute them at the next to last site, taking into account the probabilities of all the movements rightwards from there. I'm not going to look at the algebra here, but I'm just going to show you how it works. You compute the first, you take the data and the tree, and you compute the likelihoods that are in each of these circles. This is the probability of that site at that rate, given that rate. And you can do it for all the circles in the array. How much work is that? It's as much work as doing a single rate at each site times the number of rates. So if there are four rates, it's four times as much work. Then there is a computation to put it all together that's actually much faster, doesn't depend on the size of the number of species in the tree. And it goes along the molecule, and it's just like the computation coming down the tree in that you use conditional likelihoods, say here, and the conditional likelihood here is the sum of all paths rightwards from there, but that uses these interior results, which are what you basically take some of these likelihoods, conditional likelihoods, and you update them along the molecule this way, and it's really the same. It's the same logic as you used in coming down the tree, but now you're coming along the molecule. Please.
Is that how this process
It does not assume that because it has terms in there for the probability that if you're at this site, that the number that will be here will be a contribution from here, a contribution from here, a contribution from here, and a contribution from there. And though the probabilities you'll put on making those moves will be this Markov process, the ones that would be true under the Markov process. So you can do it. You start out at one end, you go all the way down to the end here, you weight them by the equilibrium probabilities under whatever Markov process you're using for changing states. And it all works out. Here is just a little visual picture that'll give you some idea. This is the ordinary pruning algorithm that we already saw for computing at a single site the conditional likelihoods and updating them, you know, moving likelihoods down the tree. It sort of works like this. If instead you're moving along the molecule, now notice that it's not different species or different places in the tree now. It's all the stuff in the tree is already taken into account. It's different sites along the molecule. And it basically, logically, looks like that. And it's using the machinery in what this is called. It's interesting, it's called the... There are two algorithms, they both work, they both give you the same answer. One is called the forward algorithm and one is called the backward algorithm. You may think that this is because you're going forward or backward along the molecule. No. What I've been showing you is, or would if you gone through all these expressions, is the forward algorithm computed backwards along the molecule. They're really terrible names, and they both work, and it basically is working your way from the end of the molecule forwards in the molecule, and you can do it very quickly. The number of operations is the square of the number of states times the number of sites, and that is done. It's the square of the number of states times the number of sites in the molecule. So, you know, with five rates, it's five squared times the number of sites. And then getting the original conditional likelihoods that were in the array at the in the first place is five times the number of sites. So it's not too bad. It's a multiple of what you'd do if you had only one rate. There are ways, this is just more, this was to be accompanied if I did another 15 minutes of talking about the logic of it.
these things can be updated to those things and updated, you know, you're updating right to left. You can do it left to right. The whole thing can be reformulated as left to right. This was, and there is a way of doing the computation from the end of the molecule forwards, updating the conditional likelihoods here, get to here, turn around and do it backwards. And that will enable you, as you come to each site, to have information coming in from both sides and to come up with an overall probability of how much likelihood, what is the likelihood contributed by paths that pass through that point. And in principle, it's like you pick this thing and then you prune in this way and you prune in that way, but it's easier to organize that as you come down, you leave some stuff behind, and then you turn, and as you go back, you make this computation. So the likelihood can also say, for any site, is most of the likelihood contributed by the fast rate or the slow rate or what? You can get that out of this, so I won't give more. So I'm just going to show you, I have tended to use a really simple Markov chain that just says, if you're in a site, there's a certain probability of you going to one of the other sites chosen at random according to some weighted distribution. So you're not necessarily even changing to a nearby site. You're not enforcing that. But here's an example. I'll just finish up by showing you the example. This is protein likelihoods, some cytochrome B sequences aligned by Naoko Takasaki, and using my ProML protein likelihood program, we assumed only three rates, one of which is zero. You can have invariance as one of the rates. Perfectly okay. Of course, if a site is assumed to be have a rate zero, you better not see any variation at that site. But anyway, so I assumed that the Markov process has these equilibrium probabilities. It'll spend most of its time in rates two or three, but occasionally in rate one. The tree we get is this. It's almost correct, but it has a few parts that aren't. Here, this is the last thing I'll show in this. Here is a big table, four of the sequences, and we're using a dot differencing format. So we're saying that at this site, it's a leucine, in this case, African people from Africa, in cytochrome C, and also in other people and in apes, except in the gorillas, it's A's. So what you see by the dot differencing, I know the seminar is starting in 10 minutes, but leave me alone. That's almost as bad as these, there it is. Yeah, here we go. These things that come on and ask you if you want to update your software while you're giving a lecture. Okay, so you can look at this and you can see where they differ from this overall sequence. The dots all mean L. And what I'm going to start out with next time is to go along and talk about these and say, here we have the assignment of rates that's the single combination of rates that gives you the most contribution to the likelihood. And it will show some autocorrelation. And it's going to show some interesting things that happen as you try to assign rates. And I'll fill that in next time. So next time will be Wednesday. The homework is assigned. I'll get you back your homeworks hopefully there.